passe. Ouais, c'est pas possible. Un artiste. Super. Ouais. Encore un but sensationnel. That's a brilliant bit of follow-up play by Mahé. Oh my goodness me, what a shot.
Sagolsen. Sagolsen setter det hen. Han setter den. De I semifinale.
I don't know about you guys, but the last couple of weeks have been an absolute roller coaster of emotion. On one hand, we have handball coming back. It feels good. There's players playing, there's goals being scored, there's even fans in arenas. Love it. On the other hand, there's a lot of fairly scary news coming out and bringing a shadow with this imminent start of the league. So what about you, Chris? Are you feeling good about it?
I just want it to happen now. Can you delay it anymore? I think Tom O'Brannigan made a very good point on Twitter the other day when like all these this flood of bad news is coming in with like regulations in some countries and teams pulling out of the European League and injuries and stuff like that. And I think to paraphrase him, basically, we need to find some kind of balance in the end because you can't live like this forever in a kind of bubble. And at the same time, you have to take care of people. It's worked out in a lot of sports where they've managed to find solutions. I think they'll find the solutions in the next few weeks when handball really gets started internationally. So yes, overall, I'm feeling good because I think having matches back in our lives, having real competitions back in our lives is going to make things a lot better for all of us. And once it gets started, there will be a few bumps along the road, but I think overall it's going to be a good thing once the ball gets rolling.
I want to focus on the positives at the start of this podcast. I want to talk about the good news stories of the last couple of weeks. So Brian, give me your top good news story coming into this handball season.
So there's a few different things I suppose you could look at in terms of the positives. It was nice to see Barcelona lifting a trophy as they do each year, you know, this the inaugural trophy lift of the Supercopa, beating Benidorm. Seeing Sagosen playing for Kiel in the Kiel jersey, that was nice also. They had an easy win in Graz. And during that game, Sagosen would have passed a few balls, I think, to a man on the wing for Kiel. Chris, tell me how to pronounce his name though. I'm not really sure. You're big into Australian stuff. Bevan Cavalea.
And I want that in Australian accent, Chris.
Yeah, please.
Right, it's Bevan Calvert. No, that's it. Bevan? Bevan Calvert? No, Bevan. Oh, God. Bevan?
Wait, now.
It's Bevan.
We've just lost 100% of our Australian listenership.
I can't get the Calvert. Shit. Bevan Calvert.
Bevan Calvert on the wing for Kiel, scoring 5. And I think it was you, Chris, obviously, who put that tweet out during the week of a man who played his handball in the second Bundesliga. Now is a coach for the under-23s team in Kiel. And because of, with this whole COVID time, there are positive and negatives, but there's always a silver lining, and he's probably the silver lining story of this, a negative for Kiel with they lost Ekberg with a broken finger, but he now probably has fulfilled his childhood dreams of playing for one of the biggest clubs in the world. May it only be for a few weeks, but he's still doing it. And I think that was a feel-good story for the last few weeks and a positive out of a negative.
I love it so much. It's so cool. It reminds me of these stories you get in America sometimes from the ice hockey, where each arena has like this third choice goalkeeper that comes in and is able to fill in for a team if there's an injury. And occasionally there are injuries to the goalkeepers. And this guy who doesn't play professional ice hockey, but is like a goalkeeper ready there, like as an emergency, comes in and has like a match winning performance. It reminds me a bit like that. You don't get that in handball, but this is a guy who he's 34 years old. As you said, only played second and third Bundesliga. I think he was playing for Kiel's second team as well as coaching. So playing in the fourth division. And then all of a sudden, there you are, playing and training alongside the Kiel team. And Sander Sagosen coming in on his big transfer from PSG, looking around at all the stars in the team. And then he's got, g'day, how's it going? Bevan's my name.
And he almost outscored Sagosen in that game. Kiel Graz. He scored 5 goals, only one less than Sagason on the left back. So maybe there's more to come.
Yeah, but he scored more goals from play, though. You know, Sagason only scored 4 from play. He got 5 from play. So,
and in Kiel's game against Altenholz, they played a preseason game before that in Altenholz, in the north of Germany, and Calvert scored more than Sagason. Sagason scored 2, Calvert scored 4. So are we saying that Bevan Calvert is now the biggest transfer of the summer for Kiel?
Could be. But I mean, he's the first native English speaker to play for Kiel, though, no? I presume. I can't.
Absolutely
no.
I think we have to get him on the podcast in the next couple of weeks. We definitely need to get his experience of what it's like to be training that team coming up from the fourth division. It's such a lovely story. I like it so much.
And we can play him your audio if you're trying to pronounce his name as well.
Shit.
No, we won't. So, Alex, I'll throw the question back at you then. What was your favourite story? Was that your favourite story, or was there another one in there that you really liked?
For me, it was a more personal moment. And that was actually a couple of weeks ago. So on the 18th of August, I was sitting at home. It was on a Sunday. And Brian, you sent a message in to our WhatsApp group and you kind of said, oh, anyone watching this? And I was like, watching what? Handball's back. What? It's a live game. And you sent a link of the final of the Struga Cup. So this is the annual outdoor tournament that's held in Macedonia every year, which looks absolutely amazing. They have this, you know, floodlight lit court outside, not many fans, kind of perfect venue for a preseason riddled by COVID. So that tournament obviously went ahead, and Vardar were playing Eurofarm in the final of that game, of that tournament. And for the first time in about 6 months, the three of us were able to sit down and watch a game together and comment on things going on in that game. Really talk about handball for once. Real handball of Mandalinic coming back, coming out of his 3 years of pretty rough injuries and underperformance in Fuchs of Berlin, coming into Eurofarm and becoming their star, at least in the preseason so far, and really dominating this Vardar team, who I think we, all of us, had a lot of hope for them, and we really thought they'd come back to the highest level. But it looks like Eurofarm, Pilester, are the team in Macedonia this year.
Yeah, it's definitely going to make for a very interesting season. Yeah, and the Macedonia League seems a lot more interesting now when you have a team like Eurofarm in there. Yeah, but it was a nice surprise to see some live handball. And it was a bit unusual as well with them playing outdoors. So it had its own little twist to it. But yeah, I had a similar feeling to you as well. I was kind of like, wait, I was like, no, this is just a replay of something else. This can't be actually true. Like almost pinching myself.
It mattered to them as well. Like there was a bit of, I think a bit more feistiness in these preseason games than there are usually. I mean, because players have been so deprived of handball for so long that imagine usually this tournament, it's more about getting fitness up and court practice, but it really mattered to the two teams. And I guess both of them, they saw it as like the first opportunity to strike a real blow at each other, because it is going to be a big like two horse race in the Macedonian League, these two relatively new formed squads. And there was a bit of scrap at the end as well. Who do you think was to blame for that, Alex?
I think the tension was high throughout the game. I think Vardar being down by 5 goals going into the last 5 minutes probably sent their blood boiling. So I don't actually specifically remember who threw the first push, but I vividly remember that it was an angry reaction from a Vardar player.
Yeah, but there was also another big preseason match that I enjoyed watching a while ago was Veszprém against Kielce. And I think that fits what I was saying before about the, I wouldn't say tension, but there was a real, it was a bit of an edge to the game, because both sides really cared about it. And in particular, the moment that sticks out to me is Sigvaldi Gudjonsson, the new right wing for Chiesa, who joined from Elverum. He had a penalty in the first half, and he bounced it just past the standing leg of Tsupara, but bounced it over the bar. What's the name of that in Danish again, Alex? Is your favorite favorite thing?
Oh, it's a snood.
A snood.
And you get a fine for it. You would always get a fine for it.
Yeah, whenever it happens in training, everyone just goes wild. So he did that, bounced it over the crossbar, and he was livid with himself. I mean, maybe that was his first chance to score like a proper goal for Chiesa, and he was raging as he went back. And eventually he got another chance at a penalty in the second half and he scored it. So everything was fine. But the game itself was quite good. And Chiesa won in Vesprem, first of all. There was a crowd there and a pretty substantial crowd as well, particularly at the standing end for Vesprem, which I was flabbergasted by, that so many fans would be allowed inside. 2,500, which is, that's really something. that's happening in Hungary at the moment. Not sure if it's what the best practice, but look, it's good to see fans back inside the arena again. And yeah, both sides taking it pretty seriously, like not rotating the bench too much. And Vesprem in particular, they just have so many players to choose from. But I'd say there was a core of 9-10 players that played the majority of the match, and then other players came in and out every now and then. But I was so impressed by Chiesa, how they managed to, not just to win the game, because yeah, winning a preseason game isn't the biggest thing in the world, but once again, Talant Dushabaev just manages to, no matter what kind of player he has in the squad, he's going to force each and every one of them into some kind of role and to fit into the team in some way and contribute in some way. And he actually seems to have two pretty decent players in every position as well. And so they're looking pretty good, I think, in preseason.
Were there any players when you were watching thinking, it's strange to see them in a Vesprem jersey now?
Well, first of all, it took me a moment to remember whether Rogério Moraes was actually a Vesprem player.
I was just about to say the exact same thing. I was watching it going like, he's always played for them, no?
I was like, where has he been? besides that, yeah, I mean, Corrales didn't play at all, I think. I think it was Tsupara in goal for like an open play for the whole 60 minutes. So we saw Corrales sitting on the bench, which was a bit interesting. Now, besides that, who else is there? Jorge Maqueda looked like he fit in perfectly. He was taking the penalties from the off. He was just like, just came into the dressing room, I bet, and just like, with all those stars, balls out, I'm taking the penalties. It's exactly what I predicted a few weeks ago. He's going to be the man for them this season. And so, yeah, it's just so many big names there. And I don't know if there was anyone that didn't look like they fit in. I think Patrick Ligatvari will take a bit of time to really get up to speed. Was there someone in particular that stood out to you, Brian?
Interesting to see how Danny Dushabaev was featuring quite a lot for Chiesa, and he seemed to be playing quite well also. So he's going to be, because he had a bad injury, ankle injury, wasn't it, last season?
He ruptured his ACL at the World Championship.
That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. God, it seems like so long ago now. Mm. But it was nice to see him featuring quite a lot as well, and he seemed to be doing quite well. And yeah, but it was, yeah, it's going to take a while to get used to all these new faces.
Yeah, for me, Vesprem have played. They played three friendlies coming into the season, and they lost all of them. I've actually watched a couple of their games, just kind of replays, because all the games are live streamed and posted on YouTube. So it is nice to be able to catch up afterwards. And they seem like a bit of a mess, to be honest. They haven't looked very good. They played their first game of this season in the Hungarian League and they won that match. But they're going to do that throughout the whole season. Their squad is too big for any team in Hungary except for maybe Szeged to compete. And even in that game, they were only one goal up at halftime and then switched their whole rotation and put on a fresh team with players like Lekai and Borazan, who just rolled over their competition. But there doesn't seem to be cohesion at the moment in the way they're playing in the kind of fixed attack. It seems like they're facing the exact same troubles that they've had for a long while of not knowing what their best rotation is, who are their best players, when they should play. And it's going to work for a while, but I have kind of significant worries about when they come up against a team that is able to match their, let's say, first team squad and their full extended squad. They're not just going to be rolled over by fresh players. It just kind of looks like a mess to me at the moment. And part of that is, I think for me personally, is the fact that they're playing and relying so much on Petr Nenadić at centre. And Petr Nenadić had a great season. He was the player of the year for Veszprém last year. And we all know what he can do as a one-on-one player, and he is a superstar. He can make anything happen out of nothing. But the team does not flow with him at centre-back. Like, they have Lekai and Kenton Maia, two guys who can really run an offense, really kind of sacrifice their own goals for a team, while Petr Nenadić is kind of the opposite of that. And when you have this kind of star-filled backcourt, even, with two guys who need service, guys like Borazan and Makeda, they need a player to just deliver the ball to them and they're just going to roll over anyone. With Petr Nenadić, he basically, most of the time, he just swerves into one of the backcourt positions and scores goals through that. He can do that. But it gives this disjointed feeling with the squad. And I think that's the key for Veszprém to figure out going into the season.
So do you think Nenadić is suited better to a team that maybe when you don't have those big massive shooters and you maybe have left back and right backs who prefer to go one against one, and he's the kind of glitch that maybe can break those type of teams down maybe?
I think so. And I think he needs to be the star of a team. He needs to be the guy who takes that shot. And I don't necessarily think that putting Petr Nenadić as the star of Veszprém is their best solution. You know, feed Borazan. Like, we've seen what Borazan can do. Just feed that guy and you're going to roll over teams. Without that service, I think, yeah, it just becomes a bit disjointed.
That's reminded me of someone who, to answer Brian's earlier question, did actually take me a moment to get used to being in a Veszprém jersey, because there was a moment when both Petr Nenadić and Nikolaj Markusson were on the same backcourt. And by the way, Nikolaj Markusson is fucking beefed up now. He's been skinny his whole life, and all of a sudden he's very thick. So he's been doing the weights in preseason, that's for sure. But there's just so many players in that backcourt, and yeah, they do need somebody to tie it all together. They do have two very good players to tie it all together, and that's Lekai and Kenton Mahé. So we'll see where Nenadić fits into that. Maybe he's going to have to be more of a left back. One of the 17 left backs alongside Borazan and Lauga and Markusson. And there is quite literally three very good international class players in each of the backcourt positions.
I think if they can get it together, if they find the right combinations, I really think it is finding the right combination of backcourt players to play like sections of the game and find their one rotation that is the closing rotation, the team that when they're going in last 10 minutes, level, two goals down, whatever, what players do you play to just win them in the game? And I don't think they know that at the moment.
Jorge Macedo is definitely in there.
But I don't think he's in there with Nenadić. I think that's the issue.
No, it's a fascinating issue. It's a lot for them to think about. And that post-match interview after the Kielce game, David de Vries was, I wouldn't say he was distraught, but the way he was talking about the attack, he was like, in training, everything is perfect all of the time. I'm happy with training and how it's going. But then when it comes to the matches, they're just not scoring the goals. And it's like, if we're going to have to train 3 hours a day of just shooting one-on-one with the goalkeeper, we're going to have to do that. So, he's spoilt almost. And we'll see if he can figure it out. I mean, it's a good position to be in, though. You know, having too many players to choose from is not a bad position. And they've got the Ceja League Final Four So a few big games for them to start figuring things out before the Champions League starts.
And another positive news story on the other side of that game is Chiesa, or Lomza Viva Chiesa now. So the new sponsorship that has come in and really solidified the club. I think that's huge for handball. They've come out and, you know, extended contracts like Karalek, and they've really shown that this investment isn't just something to tie them over. This is a long-term push for the club that they're happy with. And yeah, there's a lot of, yeah, I think positive energy and positive momentum coming from Chiesa in this situation, who also have a few nice players coming in. I think Nicolas Tournat has been a great player for them and a great signing for them, and he started off very well. I think he is a real star, and if they can feed him, as they have done towards Aguinaldo for so many years, he can really become, you know, one of the premier stars of the handball world.
Yeah, him and Karalek on the line is quite a formidable duo, huh? That's a scary, scary thought, and great for Chiesa. And yeah, like I said before, I think they're building a good squad there. Talent Dushibayev will force whoever is there to play a role, even if it's like Tomas Gabala coming in as in the center of defense and scoring the odd goal, or turning Danny Dushibayev into the playmaker he really wants him to be. I mean, I don't know how many times I see Danny Dushibayev. He never looks like a playmaker, but he's always in there. And as Brian said before, he wasn't looking too bad in that Vesperm game.
I don't want to jump around too much now, but there's something you mentioned earlier, and it just came back into my head there. When you're talking about Bevan Calvert, do you think the wing position is the only position you could do that in handball? Because if you have a keeper, a handball keeper who plays fourth division or fifth division, or even, well, I think maybe second division handball would probably be definitely okay, but maybe at that very, very top level, the wing position is the only position you get away with bringing in a player who's maybe on slightly on a lower level to the rest of the team.
Why is that? Because of they're not so involved in tactics, maybe?
Maybe. I mean, I find it hard to imagine you'd be able to do that with a line player now, for example. I think they just completely get mauled out of it.
Christian Schwarzer is a great example of that, isn't he? From the 2007 World Championship.
Yeah.
Isn't it him? He had retired, and then he was like part of the TV studio team, and then got brought in, ended up winning the World Championship.
But yeah, I think that's an opposite. That's a player. The line position, I think, is a position where a player very experienced at a high level can keep playing until, let's say, their 40s and still be able to put in a shift. They'll just get broken eventually. That's why usually they stop earlier. I think I fully agree that probably the wing is, especially on defense as well, it's not a key position, let's say a core position in the defense. And for games, preseason games like this, where Kiel are expected to win and kind of roll over teams, which they have, really, if you can run a fast break, you're doing pretty well and you'll score some goals.
So you're saying chances of Alex lining out for Aalborg on the line this season are slim?
I'd say fairly slim, but chances of you lining out for Kiel are better than me lining out for Aalborg.
Give me a call, Kiel. Give me a call.
That left-hand privilege as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You gotta love that.
So as you said, Alex, at the very start, that you want to start with the positives and then end with the negatives, you know, so finish on a low. But should we go over some of the sadder stories that we've come across over the last few weeks? Do you think Nikola Bilic's injury is probably the biggest injury news that we've heard of?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I don't know. It depends on what you consider a big player. I mean, I'll list out a bunch of players for you. Bilic, you've got Michaela Messing, you've got Estevana Pullman, Maisa Pessoa, all with ACL injuries. They're probably, I would say, the four biggest names. Estevana Pullman might be a bigger name in that sense, or a bigger loss to their team as well, to Nikola Bilic. But I want to get your opinion on these injuries, because it seems at first glance catastrophic. But is this just what happens during the preseason?
this many, though, is it? I don't remember a season with this many kind of ACL injuries. I mean, something like Ekberg with a broken finger, I think, can happen at any time. I don't think that's something that you can really, you know. But when you see ACL injuries, you do always kind of feel like, especially in training as well, you do feel like there's something maybe going on there in terms of maybe their bodies are trying to do too much or they're being overworked in some way. But maybe I'm remembering wrong. Maybe it's just we have a heightened awareness now because of everything that's going on. We're just kind of maybe looking for that could be the reason, but maybe, I don't know. What do you think, Alex?
I don't think it's actually that much more significant than in previous times. I don't have the facts to back that up, but I think any preseason, injuries like ACLs do happen. And that's more down to, I think the player than the overall situation. And for me, comparing it to other sports, so when football came back and we saw this kind of straight range of injuries come in at the start, most of them were actually muscle injuries or soft tissue injuries. So actually quite different. I know they're different sports and different requirements happen, kind of. Muscle injuries aren't as significant in handball as in football, but it was a different type of effect of kind of a long break affecting players' kind of soft tissue injuries. In the NBA, I think it's been at this kind of similar level to handball where there are injuries, but at just a small step above normal injury rates. And I believe that we're just kind of on a slightly higher level than normal injury rates that we would see coming into the season. What I do worry about is that we're still in preseason. And when the teams start playing real tough kind of competitive matches, then we might see this being extended. To be honest, I've been following a lot of the training camps that the teams are holding right now in preparation for the season. And to me, they just seem a little bit old school, especially the German teams. I've noticed it with the German teams. It looks like they haven't put in more kind of time and research into what a significant layoff of 6 months might bring to a start of a season. So the training camps have just been very normal preseason training camps. They go away, they do some running in the park, they do some circuit exercises, they go into handball training and play some friendly matches. This is very standard. I feel like there needed to be some extra thought put into what a more significant period off would, how that would impact a team. And I just don't think, comparing it to also the NBA, for example, I don't think handball has the technology or the budget to really lean into that approach. I don't know if you guys have seen in the NBA bubble, and a couple of the players have kind of these blogs that there are vlogs going on where they just, you know, show their daily life, which has been really interesting. But one of the things that I've picked up from it is the extent of technology that's available to them for recovery and for, let's say, prehab. They have these infrared tents. They have, you know, ice as much as they want all the time. But it's just this kind of next step of technology that allows them to get into better shape. And I haven't noticed that around handball at all in this preseason. So that's my worry, is that they might be okay now, but the step up, so they've gone from a very low level to a medium level kind of altogether. And then when the matches go up to 100%, go to full intensity, the players just won't be ready for that. So I'm a bit nervous.
Do you think I mean, you're saying it's a bit old school, this preparation, but do you think that obviously NBA teams, they obviously had a lot more money to invest in such equipment and so on, and that a lot of the team handball clubs now maybe are feeling the pinch. And we know that Kiel, for example, I think the players have taken a, is it a wage cut, or did it take away the not getting paid for the, for how long? What was it again?
Yeah, I think it was a 50% deferral until the end of the year.
Yeah. So you think maybe a lot of that might come down to clubs not being able to afford such kind of standards of treatment that other, you see in other sports maybe?
I agree. I think comparing to the NBA is probably two different levels of kind of financial strength. But I think it's short-sightedness from the clubs to not invest in that, to not kind of really try to make an effort to go an extra step on that side to avoid further issues. Like, you know, now Kiel have two or three injuries, Flensburg have two or three injuries. That's three players gone for a significant time of the year. And the cost of, you know, getting another player in or just covering is way more significant than a little bit of investment at the start to really try to avoid that.
Yeah, 100% agree there. And I think there's a lot that can be done without costs as well. I mean, a lot of it is planning what you're doing in preparation. Every team has their strength and conditioning coaches, and it is a case of just asking them or talking to them about putting together a different plan as well. I mean, that you can go a long way from, like you said, Alex, just running around a track a few times or around the park a few times and then straight into the hole and hope for the best. I think there's a lot that can be done for relatively little cost. And maybe that's something that has to be taken into consideration when we look at early season results as well. Maybe some teams are taking it a bit slower when it comes to tactics or pure power when it comes to players, and they're focusing more on just getting them up to speed, maybe a bit slowly, and taking it a cautious way in comparison to previous preseasons. So it's these kind of things we'll only know, I guess, after a few more weeks. And as you said, Alex, once the season begins properly and everyone's playing two matches a week, what the results are. But yeah, you got to hope that there's not too many more injuries, or will become fairly clear that there is a problem there. And hopefully we'll get a strength and conditioning coach on the next podcast as well to talk about their preparation with the team and what they think about this current situation.
Yeah, because it's the only way to really know what's going on, because, I mean, a few Instagram stories here and there maybe don't give you the full picture of what's going on behind the scenes. But in terms of COVID cases now, and we've seen a few of them with stuff like Stoilov probably being the biggest name, Meltzer getting a few cases, a few of the French sides also have had some cases. Where do you think we're going to be in 2 months now with this kind of situation with COVID cases kind of just popping up and rearranging games and playing maybe only one leg instead of two legs, for example, as we've seen that has been a solution in some situations? Where are we going to be in 2 months? Do you think we're still going to be having to push different fixtures all around the place, or do you think we'll get to a point where they might have to hit pause just on a league for in total just for a few weeks, or where do you think we're going to be?
I think that's a really interesting question of where do the organizations put the blame, let's say. So do they just cancel games, and if you're not following COVID rules, as required, then you will get cases and then you have to forfeit a game. And we just lose a bunch of games this season. Or do they just get to a stage where it becomes unmanageable and cancel it and kind of ruin it for everyone? What solution do you think? So if we get, as you mentioned, 2 months into it, and we have a bunch of these games getting cancelled, if you were sitting as the decision maker in the French league, which has seen kind of a lot of these cancellations, Chris, what would you do? Would you cancel or just get teams to forfeit games continually?
I think after what we've just gone through in the spring with having everything cancelled in handball, like in other sports, things have been postponed and now they've been finished in the last month, but everything in handball has basically been cancelled except for the men's Final Four, which has been pushed back to December. I think you do your best to avoid a repetition of that. and postpone. You play as many games as you possibly can until a certain date. I don't know, March or April or something. And then see where it stands and try and find a solution then, which could be a replica of a bubble. So you get, say, when it comes to national leagues, so the French league, you get all of the teams or teams that need to catch up with games. You put them in the national training center just outside of Paris and have them play two or three games a week until they catch up. We just say, okay, once you need to postpone a game, you lose the home right to that game, and either you find an alternative date by February or March, or in April, you're going to have to play at the national training center and just try and find a way around it, because anything is better than having everything cancelled like we just had. And I think reading some comments online as well and getting like the feeling from some people, not just in handball, but in other sports, people have already forgotten that everything was almost cancelled a few months ago. And so, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, just start again. But with the same expectations as we had in January of this year, you know, you have to try and be a bit more flexible and try and find a solution in the end. I think a good example of, or a positive example, which gave me a bit of hope, was the Melsungen.
No, Chris, sorry. We're talking about negative things here only. You can't.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, shit. No, all right. Continue. Well, the
this is the negative hour now.
The anti-negative, the double negative, was the Melsungen case, where one of them got COVID, and there were two people that was in contact with, Finn Lemke and Silvio Heinefetter. Now, everyone else in the squad got tested. They all came back negative. So they're allowed to play their European League game, which is happening this weekend. And then the two players that were the first contact person to the guy with the case, they're still in doubt. I mean, the game will be played by the time this podcast is released, so we'll see what happens to them. But that is a very clear solution that was found. You know, they discovered a player had it through testing. Everyone else didn't have it, so they're going ahead with it. I know maybe it's not an exact science, because as we know, these cases, they pop up at any time between, I don't know, 6 and 14 days. So you can't be certain, but I think you have to live life as normal as possible until you have symptoms. I think that's the way things have to go now. So that was quite a positive example of finding a solution there with the case instead of just canceling it. Will that be okay when, let's say, PSG play against Kiel late in the season, in like the quarterfinals or something, or in the final four, and Sander Sagosen has it? The game goes ahead, but Sander Sagosen has to sit out. I don't know. It'll be a different case then, but at the moment, it seems like a good solution to me. What would you do, Alex?
I would say put it on the clubs to, so if cases happen, you either cancel game. I would say if there's significant cases and they can't field a team, then you cancel a game and that's it. You know, you lose those points. It's tough, but we have to be strict right now. And if some players are sick, as you mentioned, they just go down as injuries. You know, injuries happen throughout the season. Teams are never full strength, so this is just another factor into it. So, for example, yes, Stoilov got COVID, but the rest of the Varda team got tested and they were okay. So,
do we know that for a fact? That everyone else is, yeah?
Yeah, so that they were tested and there was no further positive cases. So in this case, you know, that you can roll with that. There's no huge panic in this case. And obviously you have to hope for the health of the players that they recover from this. But I think at this moment in time, most of the athletes who have had COVID across all sports, there's been very few cases of people getting, you know, significant health issues. A lot of the time, the big risk is just the spread that can happen from it. So you accept that and you try to move on.
What do you think about the extreme examples we've seen in the last few weeks of teams having to pull out of the European League. So the EHF second tier club competition. We've seen Valur from Iceland. We've seen two Norwegian teams have to pull out. And as Brian mentioned before, the game between PAOK and PAOK from France and the Spanish team. What are they called? Bidasoa Irún. Is going to be a one-off game. Also, there's going to be a one-off game between Esch and Fadi Winterthur from Switzerland. So some teams have had to pull out. I guess it's acceptable in their minds to pull out of the second-tier competition. Will it be acceptable in the Champions League? I don't think that's going to be such an easy topic. And we've seen in some sports now, there's like discussions with governments about having special exemptions for top-level athletes to travel to countries despite restrictions. That'll probably be the case in football. Will it be the case in handball, though? If every other team in Norway is not allowed to play, but Elverum has to play the Champions League, will they be allowed to?
I think if we're looking for one answer to this is the way it's going to be, I think it's going to be absolutely impossible. I think we're going to have a mix-mash of almost everything that we've said so far in terms of, like, we're going to have situations where teams will get it, like we've had with Stoyloff. He's the only person who got it. Everyone else came back negative. Then you're going to have a case where the whole team gets it. Because I find it incredible that it was only three players from Melsungen and it was only Stoyloff, because I presume he must have been positive at least once when he trained and the transmission just didn't happen, which is really incredible, because you're going to think about a sport where you could transmit the virus easiest. People thrown around a sticky ball, sweating on each other and grabbing each other would probably be the best way to get the virus. But so it is kind of a...
Nobody wants to touch Stoyloff in training.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. And the line players, well, he's in the mix there the whole time as well. But it is a slight positive to hear that news that it wasn't this massive spread that the whole club had it, that it was kind of limited to a few players. But I think we're going to see everything. We're going to see every kind of situation where you're going to have clubs themselves having to push off a load of fixtures, or maybe, like we've seen where you only play one leg of the thing. But the Champions League is going to be very, very difficult. There was something else I wanted to say. What was I going to say there? Oh yeah, but do you think we're going to end up in like some sort of utopian future where clubs like West Brom are going to have their COVID A and COVID B team who don't meet, but they have like these two different squads who could play, and you have West Brom A who play week one and West Brom B. So then if one of the team gets it, then they'll always have, oh, West Brom B can play and slot in here.
I think West Brom are literally the only squad that can do that.
Yeah.
Big advantage for them. There you go. West Brom this season.
I'm not sure I answered your question though. I kind of went off a bit on a bit of a tangent there. What was your question again?
Well, Champions League. Are they going to have exceptions? Like, are teams going to pull out, or are governments going to, like, at the moment, travel? Like, it seems Norway's kind of a no-go for letting teams in. Hungary, I believe, are going to close the borders to international travel from Tuesday, or at least that's what I read yesterday from a tweet by Kevin Domas. So are there going to be exceptions to this for top-level sports teams?
I think there should be. I think because the top-level sports teams have their own regulations in terms of testing, and that has also been outlined by the EHF, there's, to play a game, you need a squad to have been tested and all been negative 72 hours before the game. You know, all of these regulations are in place. They will most likely travel kind of themselves, you know, localized as a team. They're not arriving at different times and leaving at different places in the new country. At least they arrive and then get on a bus, go to a hotel, and they stay together. All of these rules are put into place to kind of make sure that the spread is contained as much as possible in the unfortunate case that there is a positive COVID result. And that is completely different to, let's say, normal traveling. You know, booze up Brits abroad, arriving on a plane. And
can you say that a bit more clearly again, Alex?
And hitting the Magaluf Strip. That is completely different to what a professional team does when they arrive to a different country. So I think that's why they should be able to get this exemption.
Who stopped Brits abroad? Brilliant.
What's your gut feeling now about, because I don't know what you think, but I think it's very, it seems very far-fetched that the Final Four was going to take place in December. It seems like it just seems silly almost to even think about that. It seems like you should almost focus on this season and focus on getting those games done rather than trying to hold the Final Four. I mean, you're just going to be holding, I mean, I can't imagine to be a crowd. I mean, there was some German news, DW Sports put out a tweet there during the week that they say there'll be pretty much no chance of having any fans in any football stadiums by the end of 2020. Mm. So that the Lanxess Arena does probably fits in with that as yeah. well.
Maybe it'll have to be somewhere where it is allowed.
So London, like you always wanted, Chris.
I don't think.
Shipping container.
Into the shipping container. Yoga Benito.
Handball
First
Island.
Goal wins. Yeah. Handball Island. Yeah. Get Dana White on the phone.
Yeah.
No, I think I heard in Sweden now they're considering having 30 to 40% capacity for football. In Denmark, there's been fans at football for months. Life seems to be as normal in Hungary at the moment, judging on that Vesprem game and the first European League game. So
yeah, but do people want that? You know, so this is the whole point of moving it, was to make sure that the event was this premium event, Champions League final, and even though it doesn't matter for the new season, at least we get this spectacle in the middle of it when things are possible. So now it looks like that we're not going to get this premium event with fans, with good coverage, and we're also not going to get anyone caring about it, because I don't care about it, really.
I've got it. Okay. Here's something you'll care about. Right, that's in the perfect world where Norway and Denmark do host the Women's Euro this December. The final weekend is going to be in Oslo. So keep Friday and Sunday for the Women's EHF Euro semifinals and finals. Thursday and Saturday, Champions League. Sander Sagosen wins his first Champions League in Oslo.
I subscribe.
Come on!
Retweet.
Yes.
How big is the arena in Oslo?
I think it's like 12,000 maybe. Mm. But like, if you can get any fans in there, yeah, I mean, yeah. Why not? Yeah. I don't know what the current situation is with the Euro. Just hoping for the best. But look, if you can have a major championship in Europe and it's hosted by the EHF, why not put the other one in there? Could be a glorious couple of days for Norway.
But you think it's important enough to really try and push and hold on to it in some way?
I don't know. Everything else in the European calendar was cancelled for this season. I don't know. It'll be an added bonus, I would say. I wouldn't risk my life for it, but it would be a nice thing to have around Christmas time. Why not? If it's possible. Who knows what's going on in the deep, dark offices of the decision makers, but yeah, we'll see. It still feels so far away. Like, if you consider how quickly things change, when it comes to the spread or the lack of spread, it's not changing too much at the moment, but opinions and regulations seem to be changing at a quicker pace at the moment. So I think a lot can change by December.
So do we have any positive news to finish on? Or is this Chris Masser plan to have a Final Four in Oslo? Is that our positive spin on this whole episode?
Why not? What a fairy tale. Sander Sagosen winning his first title alongside Bevan Calvert in Oslo.
Yeah, that's the year 2020. Imagine that's how we finished the year. Sander Sagosen and Bevan Calvert lifting the Champions League trophy.
We'll be back next week and the week after as we build up to the start of the Champions League season. And we'll have a few guests on for that as well as we really start to ramp up our preparations and preview the start of the new season.
Wishing positive vibes and good times in the future from the Handball Hour and me, Alex Kulesh. And goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye!
and Brian.
Goodbye.